Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, aka Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Ron Bailey. Ron is a science correspondent for Reason Magazine, a premier American libertarian arts and culture magazine, is the author of Eco Scam, The False Prophets of Ecological Apocalypse. He edited The True State of the Planet in 1995. He's an award-winning journalist, has produced television shows and news. His articles and reviews have appeared in The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Commentary, New York Times Book Review, The Public Interest, Smithsonian Magazine, and many more. Welcome, Ron.
I'm delighted to be with you.
I'm delighted to have you. We met at Cryonics conference last year, which was a very interesting event. Did you write about that?
No, I haven't yet. I'm actually going to be writing an article on longevity research, and that's going to be kind of the, if you will, the color in the article. And that should be appearing sometime this spring.
In your article, Earth Day Then and Now, which is on the website at Reason Magazine that has the collection of your articles, one of the things you say in there is, more important, many contemporary environmental alarmists are similarly mistaken when they continue to insist that the Earth's future remains an eco-tragedy that has already entered its final act. Such doomsters are not only fail to appreciate the huge environmental gains made over the last 30 years, they ignore the simple fact that increased wealth, population, and technological innovation don't degrade and destroy the environment, rather they preserve and enrich the environment. So this was written this year. One of the themes of your work is an optimistic view about the environment and the human impact on the environment. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I would call it realistic view, but it certainly it tends to be optimistic given the tone of the discussions around these issues. And largely because, again, if you look at the actual record of environmental improvement, for example, air pollution rates in the United States and water pollution rates are vastly lower than they were 30 years ago. If you look at most air pollutants, they're down by at least 75% and continue a steep decline. The rivers and streams, it's much harder to measure that, but the EPA data that we have on that shows that there's been at least a 50% improvement in the standard they call fishable and swimmable waters. Those kinds of things are really pretty good. As far as it goes as far as looking at population and food trends, for example, globally, the fact is that we had a population explosion, but none of the famines. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the things that people like Paul Ehrlich were saying 30 years ago, they were predicting that 4 billion people would have starved to death by now, and that didn't happen. And again, that was the result of a lot of technological innovations. The great thing is that people don't just stand there. They do something. And basically, this is the point that a lot of the ecological or the environmental community, I should say, misses, is that human beings do, in fact, can foresee things going wrong and move to fix them. And we've been able to, more than stay ahead of the curve, we've actually improved a lot of what's been going on. Again, another trend that is never mentioned is the fact that the forests in the temperate world are expanding and have been expanding for almost 50 years. And again, these are trends that we should not overlook. What we have to do is to look at why they improved and try to apply those same rules and lessons to the things that are not yet improving.
Now, one of the reasons that they improve is human, as you say, human foresight, human reaction to the evidence of their accumulating destruction of environments. And we responded to that with federal and state regulation. So one of the reasons why the air has improved, the water has improved, the forests have expanded, and so forth, is that we've had proactive government regulation to encourage those things.
Well, absolutely the case. But we're about to reach the limits of that. That's a very primitive technology when you look at it. But the government has been responsible ponderously, slowly, expensively in making these improvements. But what I'd like is a more general point is that, and I'd like your listeners to think about this, wherever, and I'm really trying to find an exception to this, wherever there is an environmental problem or has been an environmental problem, that problem occurs in what are called open access commons. And what that means is that it's an example Axel Garrett Hardin used many years ago, was the notion of a village sheep meadow. And everybody has a right to put sheep on the meadow. So your incentive for everybody in the village is to put more and more sheep on the meadow. And if you do that, you destroy the meadow. And all the sheep starve, and the villagers starve, and the meadow becomes a desert. Well, the fact is that if you see an environmental problem like air pollution, water pollution, oceanic fishery depletion is a perfect example of an open access common, or a tropical forest, deforestation in the tropics, or open access commons, what it means is that no one owns that property, or you could say a government owns that property, but no one really has the responsibility or the incentive to protect that resource. And what we find is that places where things are improving, you can do two things with a commons. Let's slow that down. Do two things with a commons. You can regulate it through government action, which is what we've chosen to do for most of these problems, and that we have had some success, like improvement in air and water pollution in the wealthier countries. But we've also had some tremendous failures, like oceanic fisheries and tropical deforestation. And so the other thing you can do with the commons, and this is what I think a libertarian and a more exciting new solution is coming along, is basically to marketize or privatize the resources so that people will be able to take care of the resources and have an incentive to do that, essentially in their own self-interest, but we get the side benefit of them protecting the resource as well.
So we won't eliminate salmon by overfishing if we have just salmon farms.
If we have salmon farms, or you look at an oceanic fishery, Iceland and New Zealand, these are wonderful cases, privatized their fisheries more than 15 years ago. And in both countries, their fisheries are coming back, in fact, are back big time and producing more fish than ever. And basically what they did was they allocated fish to the fishermen, who now no longer had an incentive to go out and hunt down every fish out there, but more like a farmer to sit there and make sure that they have enough fish to reproduce every year so they can have more. And so this has basically turned the whole thing around for both Iceland and New Zealand, whereas, as we know, off the Georges Bank and so forth, United States cod fishery is dead,
mm-hmm.
largely because it's an open access commons and it was badly regulated by the government.
Same thing's being pursued in Africa with ownership of elephants, right?
Yes, indeed, that is the case. Of course, unfortunately, the instability of countries like Zimbabwe, where this has been a success over the last 15 years, it'll be hard to see how that comes out. But it, up until the recent unpleasantness in Zimbabwe, what had happened is that the villagers had been given the right to all the wildlife around their villages, in discrete areas. And what this transformed these animals from nuisances who were, either threatening them or trampling their corn or stuff like that, it turned them into something worth protecting and offering safaris to, wealthy tourists, essentially. And all of a sudden, an elephant is no longer something that's going to eat your corn or knock down your hut, but something that will attract a lot of money to your village. And that just turned that around. Zimbabwe was one of the few countries in which elephant populations were dramatically increasing.
Now, I think most progressives take the lesson of the commons entirely in the opposite direction, which is the historical example of the enclosure of the British commons, the marketization of public lands in Britain 300 years ago, whatever it was, forcing all the folks who were using that land for agricultural purposes into the cities, impoverishing them. I think most progressives say we should have public policy that protects the commons from this kind of exploitation.
I believe they do say that, and I think they're desperately mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
The result, if you want to look historically at what happened there, is very likely the fact that the government colluded with wealthy landowners to steal what had been common land from poor people, and that was, of course, wrong and a tragedy. So I'm not saying that this is the way we go about it. I think there have to be fair ways of divvying up what commons has remained.
Well, for instance, if we were to sell pollution credits to major corporations, I would be for that if the price was set sufficiently high. And so that, we could fund national health insurance, we could fund, trips to Mars with the pollution credits that I'd be willing to sell.
I see an open access commons and health care would be a good idea. Huh? Exactly. I don't think so.
That's another thing you're against. Huh?
but, I mean, why reach for this egalitarian solution, which hasn't really ever worked in any place that's ever been tried? I mean, the fact is that, as you were mentioning, the air pollution credits, or we'll call them emissions credits, that have been created in sulfur dioxide in the United States have been wildly successful. The reduction in sulfur dioxide has been much faster than predicted, largely because what happened, and this is the great thing, and if you want to stick it to business, and I really mean this, if you really want to stick it to corporations, you need to privatize these commons. Because right now what corporations can do, and they like it this way, is that these are regulated commons. They can go to their politicians. They can hold up things for years for being improved, and they don't have to pay for the resource. If you privatize it, all of a sudden they have to pay for it, mm-hmm. and they're going to have to take it into account, and this will encourage them to develop new technologies to reduce the harm that they're doing. But if on the other hand you leave it in the political marketplace, they can be, you know, they can have their lobbyists run to Washington and delay things for years and years and years, and it will take a lot longer to get these improvements.
I'm speaking with Ron Bailey. He's the science correspondent for Reason Magazine. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio. Now, Ron, off of the policy solutions for a second, do you think that there is evidence that the climate is changing, that hottest 8 years out of the last 100 in the last decade, the hottest century on record, the hottest decade on record, all these kinds of things?
The answer, better yet, there, of course, is climate change. We're no longer in an ice age, for example, but what you mean is climate change as a result of mankind's action.
Right.
The answer is yes. And again, it's an interesting problem. There are lots of different ways of looking at this, but yes, there is certainly that. But then the next question is, how big a problem is it? And that's where you get into a lot of controversy.
Mm-hmm. You think it's on the margins?
It appears to be on the margins. There are 3 data sets that you can look at right now looking at actual temperature measurements. And it's interesting because 2 of them do not find any substantial warming at all. And those are the satellite data measurements, which have been going on for 20 years, which essentially, if you will, determine the temperature of the whole Earth every 2 days. It's a fantastic data set. And also, another data set, which is a completely independent measure, are the weather balloon data from around the world, which, interesting, you can compare to the satellite data, because what you can do is, where the weather balloons go up, you can have the satellite look exactly at that same point, and what you will find is that they agree mm-hmm. totally on what the temperature is. And then the 3rd data set, which is the one that the people who are mostly proponents, if you will, of catastrophic global warming are looking at, is a historical climate network that has been created of land, mostly land-based, but some sea-based temperature data, which shows more warming than in fact either the other 2 data sets show. And even that land data set, interestingly enough, is still only a third of what the actual climate models that everyone's relying on predict should be occurring. So none of them are actually showing catastrophic warming that is predicted by the computer climate models.
There's all kinds of evidence accumulating, the shrinking of the polar ice caps. I mean, don't you think that the correlation of all of the different...
Let's go on that shrinking of the polar ice caps first. In Antarctica, there is no evidence of shrinkage of the polar ice cap.
Okay.
If you're talking about ice caps, if you're talking about sea ice, that's a different matter, okay? And with regard to the latest reports out of Greenland, if you actually go into the data on that, and I've talked to a bunch of climatologists about it, there's no evidence of shrinkage of the Greenland ice cap either. And those are the 2 big ice caps. Now, the recent reports that you had about the North Pole being uncovered for the first time in 50 million years, it turns out that the New York Times itself, which had that as a headline, had to retract that statement later on, because essentially when you look at it, again, if you look at the actual data being used by the UN, the temperatures in the Arctic have not been increasing over what they were 70 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there is evidence that there are shifts. There's no question about that. And the basic thing, again, talking to to empirical climatologists, people who are actually measuring temperatures as opposed to modeling them in computers, what they found is most of the warming is being channeled, and there is warming, is being channeled into the winter nights, and particularly into the winter nights in Siberia and in northern Alaska, which means that the average temperatures appear to be in the winter nights in Siberia and Alaska have increased by about 10 degrees over what they have been historically. That is, in other words, instead of being minus 40 degrees, it's minus 30 degrees. This is not a catastrophe.
Okay. Next week, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change will be meeting in The Hague for 2 weeks to discuss evidence of climate change.
Yes.
This consensus panel of hundreds of scientists apparently puts the blame just where most people put it, global warming on humans, and says that we need to beef up the kind of Kyoto Protocol kind of agreements. Why is it that 95% of all scientists involved in climatology agree with this general worldview and that only 5% of scientists agree with the skeptic view?
Well, that's of course what the climatologists who think that global warming is true, that's the numbers that they give you, but the fact is that it's not an easy way to divide up the climatological community that way. What you have is a political process created by the UN called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which basically is devised, if you will, to come up with solutions to a problem. If there's no problem, then a lot of dare we say, funding and prestige go away. So there's a tendency, it's like
there's
all
more
of us,
there's more governmental funding for eco alarmists than there is corporate funding for eco skeptics. Because
the
eco skeptics
have
plenty of corporate funding.
They're getting $2 to $3 billion a year that they weren't getting 20 years ago.
Yeah, but Bala Yunus, who is one of the eco-skeptics who argues that CO2 is wonderful because it increases biomass in the Northern Hemisphere,
sure,
she gets all kinds of corporate funding.
I don't know that she does, but she may. Yeah. I honestly don't know. She's with the Smithsonian and the Harvard, and I don't know what her sources of funding are.
Yeah.
I mean, Patrick Michaels, you could point to him. He gets some funding, about 25% of his funding from the coal industry. That's quite true. But he's not the only people I'm relying on. I mean, for example, satellite data is John Christie, who works for NASA. Richard Lindzen, who gets no funding whatsoever, is at MIT. I mean, the kinds of statements, if you go to a climatological meeting, is a lot more nuanced than the kind of political statements you get coming out of the IPCC, because they know that they are confronting each other as colleagues, and they all know what the data really say, and it's a lot more nuanced than what you're hearing when it gets filtered through the press and the political processes, you know. I don't know, other than taking my say-so on it, it's kind of hard to deal with it unless you're playing in that game. But what I find interesting is this notion that government funding is somehow neutral. It isn't. I mean, if you don't have a problem, then the tons of money that have been poured into this would go away. So naturally, a scientist who thinks, of course, who's devoted his life to these issues, he thinks they're very important, he may well, shade it a little bit in order to justify what he finds fascinating to do. And that's just a normal human capacity.
The directors of federal funding agencies were appointed for 12 years by Republican administrations who were skeptical about global warming. And you don't think that Republicans are skeptical? George Bush is skeptical about global warming.
Well, no, I understand. But I'm trying to figure out what directors you're talking about. I mean, the NSF is not the main funder of this kind of stuff. Mostly it's NASA and the DOE and that kind of thing. And those people are certainly not appointed for 12 years.
Uh-huh. So,
are you talking about the NSF particularly?
Mm-hmm. But you're saying that Republican administrations have appointed eco-alarmists who have bought into some kind of left-wing conspiracy theory of ecology over the 1980 to 1992 period, to the directors of to NASA, NOAA, NSF.
Well, we have to review our history on this. The first statements talking about global warming were essentially made in 1988, shortly after the Reagan administration. That's when, I can't remember his name right now. But, I mean, this is getting a little esoteric. But, yes, I'm basically saying that the vast majority of the funding did not start until 1992.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 1896, a Swedish chemist first advanced the theory that CO2 emissions from carbon combustion of coal would enhance the Earth's greenhouse effect. So it's not an old, it's not a new idea. But
no, it's certainly not. And Al Gore certainly got that from, his buddy at Harvard, actually, when he was a professor at Harvard, whose name I'm also blanking on at the moment. So no, it's certainly been an idea that was sort of, and I'm not arguing that it's not true. I'm saying that global warming is occurring because of man made additions to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That is absolutely true. Again, the question is, how big a problem is it? Mm-hmm. And if you do a straight line calculation from the temperature data sets that we have available, it appears that the amount of warming you would see in a century would be about a degree to a degree and a half centigrade, mm-hmm. which is not terrible. And furthermore, this whole notion, by the way, let's go back to Kyoto. Think about it for a moment. Kyoto is, in many ways, essentially an enormous energy plan, central plan for energy for the next century, which is crazy. That would be like somebody in 1900 sitting down, Einstein sitting down in 1900 and basically saying, well, and predicting what our world in the year 2000 would be like. Of course, in 1900, electric lighting had barely been invented. There were no air conditioners, no refrigerators, no automobiles, no airplanes, that's just crazy. And the rate of technological progress that we're expecting in the next century will be so vastly different that sitting here in 2000 trying to plan the next 100 years of energy future of the planet is ludicrous.
Well, no, I'm entirely in agreement with you. By the way, I'm talking with Ron Bailey. He's the science correspondent for Reason magazine. And this is Change Shift for Radio. I'm entirely in agreement with you because I buy into the transhumanist or the techno-optimist idea that a variety of different technologies are converging and that the rate of technological change is ramping up to the point where we have only a horizon of social prediction of a couple of years or 5 years ahead of us. And beyond that, all bets are off. So I agree with you that any kind of long-range planning like that, and that's why I think that there are two very different questions. One, is there evidence of this global warming that we're screwing up the planet? And two, is there anything that we can foreseeably do about it through public policy? For instance, I don't think Kyoto is going to have much effect, even if we try to implement it.
Well, not on climate change it wouldn't, but it would have an enormous effect on our economy.
Right.
I mean, you may not help the climate, but you... In fact, you wouldn't help the climate if you think it's a problem, but what you would do is certainly tank the economy for no good reason.
Okay, this raises another set of questions, which is the kind of raison d'etre of my show, which is I have been a techno-optimist, an old-fashioned Wellesian utopian socialist in some respects, and have found the increasingly Luddite orientation of bioethics and left politics not to my taste. And so this show is an attempt to bring these two things back into dialogue. I mean, are there good things happening with technology? So, you know, half of everything that you say, I'm jumping up and down with excitement. But then it gets to the policy. So, like, for instance, you said here, where do the doomsters go wrong? They assumed that overpopulation drives world hunger. To the extent that such conditions exist in certain places, the real culprit was and is poverty. And then you go on to talk about how important biotech was and contraception and abortion and so forth. So you put your finger on poverty and you talk about the importance of technology as a solution to some of these problems. But then you go off in this direction, well, the solution to poverty is more markets and whatever, you know.
Right.
So, okay, what's the relationship that you see historically? Why is it that Marxists used to be the ones who were so technologically oriented, and conservatives in general, not libertarians or classic liberals, but conservatives in general, were the ones who were techno-pessimists? And why has that shifted entirely 180 degrees?
That's a historical question. Well, one thing I would want to say is that it is clearly an oxymoron to say rich socialist country.
There are no examples of
a rich socialist country. Never have been. It couldn't possibly be.
The living standard of Northern Europeans is the highest in the world.
And the vast majority of their wealth, that's, by the way, not true. Ours is, but that's another debatable point. But especially if you're looking at material things that people have. But the fact is that Northern Europeans...
As opposed to work life, leisure, life expectancy, child mortality, and things like that.
Right. But on the other hand, if you look at child mortality, theirs is 9, and ours is 7 and theirs is 6 per 1,000 live births. It's not a big difference.
Our health indicators are 20th in the industrialized world.
No, those were cobbled together figures that the UN needed to do to come up with it. I mean, those health indicators are health span kind of judgments, and those are notoriously slippery. And I think you should go back and look at how those were derived by the World Health Organization. Well,
statistics are damn lies. I'll concede you that.
There are reasons for why they wanted to come up with that answer, and they came up with the way they wanted it. But anyway, all that aside, the answer I think is that why are libertarians techno-optimists and the leftists tend to be Luddites nowadays? The two things is that, well, first, libertarians are in favor of freedom, and technology is the most freeing thing that we do. We're free from hunger. We're free to go where we want. We're free to communicate with whom we want. These kinds of things. Technology expands our range of choices and betters our lives. And technology is the result of markets and wealth. In fact, technology, without wealth, you won't have technology. And the left believes the problem is that technology nowadays exacerbates inequality. And the one of the equality is the central value of the left, or there is no central value on the left anymore.
Yeah,
and the fact
that's,
is...
That's pretty true.
I'm sorry?
That's pretty true.
Yeah. What? There is no left anymore?
That the left has lost track of what their central values are.
Well, if it isn't equality, there isn't a left. But the problem is that technology and markets basically appear or are perceived by the left to increase inequality. But the fact is that I don't think that's true, and I would like to engage with my leftist brethren on this, because if you just look at different societies, what society was more equal? A medieval society with a king and a whole bunch of peasants, or a society with Bill Gates and me? The fact is that Bill Gates has, I don't know, trillions of dollars, but the fact is I still have an enormous amount of freedom, and in fact I have almost as much as he does, with regard to my comings and goings and who I see and, you know, whether I'm starving to death and so forth, whereas a king versus a peasant in a medieval time, they were a lot more equal in terms of material goods.
Well,
the fact is that, you know...
It's an interesting example that you raise, because Bill Gates... Marx would have been delighted with Bill Gates, and he would be delighted with the argument that you're making, because Marx and traditional Marxism argued that technology, the change in the means of production, was precisely what created the conditions for a democratic and egalitarian society. It stripped away all the old feudalistic strictures and inequalities and created a mass public. And it concentrated wealth in the hands of monopolists, and then the contradictions, the social contradictions of monopoly control of wealth over the rest of our lives would create create the revolution or create calls for the democratization of that concentrated power. And you had Sun Microsystems director calling for the public ownership of Microsoft as part of the public commons, which I was very much in support of.
The problem is that whenever you do that, then you also cut off the sources of wealth creation, and you're cutting off the future technologies and future benefits that even the poorest of us journalists will be able to enjoy later on. In the name of seeking equality now, you're cutting off a better future for everybody. The contradictions of leftism with regard to that are just amazing to me.
Do you think the left is dead, or do you think the native...
No, I think the impulse of the left is always going to be there. Uh-huh. And it's a kind of what Hayek was talking about, is a tribal impulse trying to apply the rules of family life to justice, essentially. Justice being a system of rules that apply, we hope, equally to all. What people really want is to have special pleading of the of family life, where they can go and say, you know, Uncle Joe is an alcoholic, we really ought to take care of him, and blah, blah, blah. Basically, people do not like living in large extended societies of the sort that we have, and therefore they want to, the impulse to socialism really is an emotional one, to a call for reducing our emotional lives back to the level of families. Which is why you hear politicians always talking about, you know, the Democratic Party is one great big family, or America's a family. It's more than a metaphor, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Swedes called their socialist state the Volkshem, or the people's home.
Exactly. And that impulse will be with us until we can technologically engineer it out.
Okay, well, that's another show. You gave me the perfect segue. I've been speaking with Ron Bailey. He's the science correspondent for Reason Magazine, the premier American libertarian magazine. He's the editor of Earth Report 2000 and the author of EcoScam, The False Prophets of Ecological Apocalypse. His articles for Reason Magazine and other publications are available at www.reason.com, and there are links to there from changesurfer.com website. Thank you very much for being with us today, Ron.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's J-H-U-G-H-E-S at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Previous Change Surfer radio programs can be listened to from www.changesurfer.com and streaming MP3, thanks to the Radio for All project.